Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. It's 11:01, so I'm thinking actually we'll just let people continue to filter in and we'll get going, if that's all right, Adrienne.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
So firstly, the most important thing of the day for me is welcome to Employment Law 101.
Oh, is this the bit where I have to do jazz hands? That's the bit you're talking. So here's my jazz hands.
That's the jazz hands.
Okay, thanks.
Anyway, we are perfectly aligned. We are Adrienne Hardy, no matter what she might be telling you, and Sarah Wilder from MPM Legal. MPM Legal, for those of you that don't know, and I'm sure you do, is a boutique employment law and business immigration firm, and we're based in Henley-on-Thames, but we've got clients all over the country, and actually we do international work with some great partner firms as well. So we set up these Employment Law 101 sessions at the start of the autumn to give our clients and contacts a coffee break size dash through some really important topics in the employee life cycle. This really is going to be a dash through today, because today's topic is enormous. It's one of my favourites. And as someone who also has a real keen personal and professional interest in diversity and inclusion, it's a real crossover subject. But it is massive. And so our hopes of getting through the whole of discrimination in detail in 23 to 28 minutes are zero. So what we're going to do instead is give you a whistle-stop tour through the key types of discrimination, and then centre in on some things that we think are really important, some watch-outs for you, and some things that we think you're going to come across in your day-to-day working lives, and that we certainly come across in our day-to-day practice. Does that about sum it up, Adrienne?
Yeah, absolutely, because there's no way we can cover it unless, of course, everyone's got a spare week and we'll just keep the webinar running all week and no sleep, and that's it. We'll stop for coffee, maybe.
Yeah, or I could just talk really fast and try and do like that, but I don't think that would be very satisfactory for everyone. So, okay, so let's dive in then. The four key areas that you need to be aware of in terms of discrimination are, firstly, direct discrimination. Now, direct discrimination is pretty self-explanatory. It means that you discriminate against someone because of a protected characteristic, and you treat them differently to someone who doesn't have that protected characteristic. So, for example, if it were really Peter on the screen today, and Peter was paid less than me on the grounds that he's a man, that would actually be an equal pay claim, but there's a discrimination angle there as well. Or perhaps if Peter, one that can come up quite often, surprisingly, is part-time working. So if Peter wasn't allowed to work part-time because he's a man, and I was allowed to work part-time because I'm a woman, that would give Peter a clear case of direct sex discrimination. So that's direct discrimination. It's putting two things next to each other and saying, because of your characteristic, we're going to treat you worse, effectively. I was going to say differently, but let's be honest, it's generally worse.
Yeah.
So that's direct discrimination. So pretty straightforward, nothing much to add there. The next area, and we're not going to go into this in great detail, but on all of this stuff, if there's if we talk about things and you think actually I'd love a much more detailed session on that, then of course drop us a line. Let us know, because we can always, you know, we want these webinars to work for our clients, so we can always do a bit more of a deep dive into things. But we're not going to deep dive into harassment today, other than to say harassment, there are actually two forms of harassment. So there is harassment generally, and confusingly, that can include harassment on grounds of sex, so sex-based harassment, but that's different to sexual harassment. So the two types of harassment share characteristics. So effectively, they're both about putting someone in a position where the environment that they're working in is hostile to them. It's degrading, it's intimidating. Now, that could be for any protected characteristic, including sex. And what I mean by that is an environment that's uncomfortable because of someone's sex. So for example, if someone is making sexist jokes, now, you don't have to be a woman to be upset by sexist jokes in these enlightened times, but that would be a form of sex-based harassment. Sexual harassment is something different. It's still based around that kind of feeling really uncomfortable and hostile, but it's harassment of a sexual nature. So, you know, the sort of unwanted touching that I think that most people of mine and Adrienne's generation, most women of mine and Adrienne's generation, probably were subjected to when we were young professionals.
It might be texts as well, mightn't it? Might be unwanted texts,
could be
pestering out,
You know, someone persistently asking someone out and not quite getting the vibe that it's not appropriate and it's making someone feel uncomfortable. So it's all of those kinds of issues, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the thing with harassment is that the key point there is you're absolutely right. You don't have to have the protected characteristic yourself. That might be the subject of the harassment. So the you know, what used to be back in the day known as banter, which we all hear about, which we know isn't really acceptable anymore in certain ways, is that might be something that makes somebody feel uncomfortable if it might have a racist element, or it might be, you know, an age-based thing. You don't have to have that person's age, you don't have to have that person's race to be in that uncomfortable environment, and that you could then have a harassment claim.
Yeah, so that's truly a whistle-stop tour through half of the sort of areas of unlawful discrimination that you need to be aware of. We're going to slow down a little bit now, I think, and look in a bit more detail at indirect discrimination and victimisation. And I think we're going to cover indirect discrimination first and hopefully try and answer that question of what on earth is a PCP? Adrienne, what's a PCP?
Well, I mean, what is a PCP? I always think I get it confused with TCP, which, you know, is an antiseptic, and clearly that's not the case. But I think with indirect discrimination, you read the statutory definition and my God, what a mouthful. It's, you know, it's you've got to put in place this PCP, which is a provision, criteria or practice. And I have to say, when this first came out, this PCP, I immediately switched off at that point and thought, I'll worry about what that is later. Applying that PCP puts a group of employees at a particular disadvantage, and the employee in question who's complaining about indirect discrimination is one of the members of that group who has that particular disadvantage. And then you add the final layer on top. You as the employer can't justify this. You can't show that you're doing this as a reasonable way of achieving your business need. So that's the statutory definition. And now everyone wake up, wake up, wake up, because you've probably all switched off going, oh my God. What does it mean? So two classic examples. Let's start with the absolute classic example, first of all. So employer says, and this is remember pre-COVID perhaps, hopefully we've all become a bit more enlightened since then. The employer says, we don't want part-time workers. So you might have a sales team and you say all sales consultants, all sales execs in that team, they need to work full-time. That's what the business needs. That's what our customer demands. And then you are potentially opening the door to a raft of claims for indirect discrimination. Classic example being a woman goes off on maternity leave. She returns, puts in a flexible working request saying, I'd like to work compressed hours, 4 days a week, 3 days a week, whatever it is. And the head of sales goes, absolutely not. No, sorry, got to work full time. Now, this is something that commonly used to come to us, and it's something that I've pushed back on many occasions to challenge a business. And under the flexible working, under the flexible working regulations, which is, you know, the method by which the request is made, it is actually much easier to push back. You've got 8 business reasons to say it fits into one of these. Therefore, we've done this investigation. We can justify it. Thanks very much. But they're sort of like the tiger behind the scenes is the indirect sex discrimination claim, because statistically more women than men take the childcare responsibilities and are therefore more likely to work part-time. So here we've got the PCP, and we'll call it the criteria in this case. In order to be a salesperson in your business, the criteria is you need to work full-time. The particular group of people disadvantaged would be working mothers. The employee in question is a working mother. They are making that complaint. So there's an example of the PCP, the requirement to work full time.
And because I'm a simple creature, I tend to even take it back and go back in time. And I've suddenly had an urge to start singing the song Back in Time, but I'm going to resist that urge. the example that, you know, and I think this was right back when I was at university, so that really is going back in time. The example,
not as far back, not as far back as me.
The example that I always go back to is, I'm pretty sure that it's not just urban legend, but it used to be the case that to be a police constable, you had to be 6 foot or over, which is great on the face of it, right? There's no sex discrimination there. It's just you have to be 6 foot or over. But again, statistics play a lot in these, play into these sex discrimination or these general indirect discrimination claims a lot, because of course, statistically, the likelihood is that far more men than women are going to be over 6 foot tall. So actually, you had a criterion that police officers have to be 6 foot or above. On the face of it, it's neutral, but when you look into it, it disproportionately affects women. So again, you then get to your, oh, okay, if a woman comes along and she's the same height as me, 5'9", I like to think of myself as reasonably tall, but I couldn't be a police officer in those circumstances, then there's an indirect sex discrimination claim. So it's all the time, when you break it down like that, it can be trickier sometimes. Not all cases are, you know, there are a lot of nuanced cases, but when you break it down, yeah, and you look for your PCP, it actually starts to become quite easy to work out, okay, is there an issue here or not, I think. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And also, can I just say, I love your example, because you're talking about PCs. And PCP. Sorry, that's all I can think of while you were talking about that. I know, definitely deserves jazz hands. Guys who are listening to us, feel free to join in with the jazz hands if that would make you happy. I think it's absolutely right. I mean, one of the other examples that I've come across as well is in the recruitment space. So, for example, and you see this actually much more in sort of lawyers advertising for so many years. PQE, post-qualification experience. So you might advertise for a management role and you say, we want 8 years industry experience. And immediately then I'd be saying to you, please don't put that in your advert, because you are potentially opening yourself up to an age discrimination claim. And, you know, it could be direct, but it could also be indirect, because the criterion that you're applying is the requirement to have 8 years experience. Uh-huh. All right. So automatically then, by virtue of time, you might be excluding a bunch of younger workers who haven't been in industry for long enough to have built up 8 years experience. But, you know, let's face it, they could have had fantastic experience. They could have absolutely smashed it out of the park and they've got exactly what you need, but have only been there for four. Yeah. So in that situation, you're applying that criterion, you're disadvantaging a group of younger workers. You get somebody who comes up and says, actually, your ad is discriminatory. The fact that you're not going to interview me or look at my CV for that role, I'm now going to bring a complaint for discrimination. And that kind of, I also think that, you know, in that perspective, let me just cover what I think I would do in that situation if I were you. I'd be saying, is it 8 years that you actually need? Because I know, for example, and it's not from personal experience, I'm just thinking about how not to dip, you know, land myself in it here. I'm just thinking that I know plenty of lawyers, for example, who might have 8 years experience. In other words, they've been sitting in the chair for that long, but they wouldn't necessarily have built up the type of experience that somebody else who would have worked in a different environment.
I'm happy to lay myself in it there, so far as good. Concerned, because I started my career, as some of you know, in the city, and I deliberately chose to go to a medium-sized firm rather than a magic circle firm for precisely that reason, because my sense, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, because I didn't go to a magic circle firm, was that I would get a much better experience, I'd get much more exposure to a
exposure
client.
To work, yeah.
If I went to a slightly smaller firm, because my sense was if I went to one of the massive firms, I would be a very small cog in a very big wheel, and I might have experience for 6 months of just working on one piece of litigation, for example, you know, as opposed to smaller things, which actually give you more on the ground experience. So I think that's a really, really valid point. I think it's a really good example of how actually you can try to sort of front load and proactively avoid being on the wrong end of a claim like this if you try not to apply a broad brush to everything, and if you try not to just kind of if you're avoiding making sweeping generalizations, you know, and that applies to your policies as well. It's being thoughtful about your policies and thinking, okay, well, on the face of it, this seems fine, but actually, am I taking a really broad brush approach here that's going to negatively impact someone? And that doesn't only have a legal connotation, it also potentially damages you from an employee relations perspective, and you might lose some really good people over it, even if they don't sue you, which we all know recruiting people is expensive, so that's not a great idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's exactly it. And that kind of brings us neatly into the final part of the statutory test, which is, can you justify your provision, criteria or practice? And the wording, I hate this wording, you know, on the basis that you have a legitimate aim and what you're doing is proportionate. Yeah. So, you know, in other words, have you got decent business reasons? So coming back to that recruitment example, why do you need 8 years experience? That's what I would be saying to you if you came to me. Why do you need 8 years experience? What is the actual experience that you're looking for? And it might be, well, we need to see evidence of managing a team, carrying out appraisals, dealing with perhaps an international element. Put all that in the job ad. Don't focus on the years. Focus on the specific things that you need, because that is your legitimate business aim, is to have somebody with that experience.
That's a perfect example, isn't it, of how specificity versus generalisation.
Yeah.
You say from a legal perspective as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing I think I'd add to that is, if you are in that situation and you think that you might have a situation where you can't avoid indirect discrimination, make sure you've got your ducks in a row in terms of evidence and empirical data to objectively justify. So the case that always springs to mind for me with that is the case a few years ago with Ford, where someone brought a case. It was about shared parental leave and pay versus maternity pay. And Ford were able to, it was an indirect discrimination claim about how men were treated versus women in terms of maternity. And I won't go into the details of it now, but suffice it to say that Ford were able to succeed in defending that claim because their aim in what they were doing was to retain women. And they had very poor statistics historically in terms of attraction and retention of women. And they were able to put forward an absolute plethora of empirical data and real data to demonstrate why they'd done what they'd done. And that then meant that they were able to objectively justify their position. So mm-hmm. I think if you're in that position and you really can't avoid something that looks a bit iffy from an indirect discrimination perspective, and you are relying on objective justification, as soon as you realise that, try and get your evidence sorted out and get your ducks in a row.
Yeah, and I think the same thing applies just to, looking at somebody's request to work part-time. You know, I would be sitting down with them and saying, how do you think it's going to work? You know, are your clients really demanding? How quickly do they demand response times? If you were to take a day off, you know, is the expectation that, you know, you would be immediately available on that day off? Or is it often the case that they can wait for 48 hours? Is those types of things? Or, you know, if is there a potential for a job share? You know, if somebody, I'm not saying that you have to go to all ends of the earth, but sometimes, and there have been cases where claims for indirect discrimination have been defended on the basis that the employer has advertised for a job share, not been able to find anybody, and therefore have said that, you know, unfortunately, by rejecting the request for part-time working, that is a proportionate way of them achieving the legitimate business aim. But it's making sure that it comes back to your generalising again. You know, don't just have this broad brush approach. I've got just put my teeth back in.
Horrible.
Yeah, exactly. Don't have a broad brush approach. Make sure that you are properly thinking about it. And I would always start from the basis of, can we make this work?
Yeah.
That's how I would start. You know, and if you can, you can. And if you can't, you can't. And if you can't, you've got the evidence because you've been through the thought process. Yeah. So
absolutely. So just looking at time, we probably need to leap forward to victimisation. Now, I think this is really, really important because the number of grievances I see from employees saying, oh, I've been victimised, and they may well be right in the English dictionary sense of the word, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're right in terms of the legal definition, does it, Adrian?
No, absolutely. So, yeah, victimisation can often just mean that they think their manager might be picking on them or somebody's picking on them. And it's victimisation in the dictionary definition, if you like. But victimisation in the legal sense of what that means is very, very specific. So an employee might have made a complaint about discrimination, or they might have been a witness or a support to somebody who's brought a complaint about discrimination. And then off the back of that, they've been treated less favourably. That is the legal definition of victimisation. So, example, OK, so And yeah, and very often in this situation, the original complaint of discrimination might be groundless. So let's just come back to the management example. Employee says, the manager's picking on me, they're managing my performance, they're micromanaging me, and that's because basically they want a younger worker on that account. They don't want me, I'm too old, they don't like me, right? So you've got a complaint of age discrimination there. You know, it's raised as a grievance, you go through your investigation process, just as we talked through last week, your fact finding. You might come back and go, right, nothing to see here. There's no discrimination. It might be a bit of an overly zealous manager, and perhaps it's a communication issue. So you put together a mediation process between manager and employee, you agree a way forward. The manager in the meantime, frankly, is totally pissed off that they've been the subject matter of this grievance. So it comes to appraisal time and the manager marks them down. Okay, so the marks them down, and the employee says, there's no evidence to justify marking me down on my appraisal. The only reason the manager has done that is because they are pissed off that I raised the complaint in the first place. So in that situation, you've got the original complaint of probably no discrimination. You've then got the act by the manager where they have essentially victimized the employee for making the complaint in the first place. So what's happened here is that a no case has been turned into a case. And that is a classic example of something that is, you know, it comes within victimization. And the other time I see it, I don't know about you, Sarah, if you've come across it, it's you might have somebody who raises a grievance and then about discrimination, then leaves, and you think, I'm not bloody well giving them a reference, and you don't give a reference when you would in any other situation. And yeah, there, again, you've turned no case potentially into a case, and the employee who doesn't get the reference can bring a complaint of victimisation.
And there has been case law on that, hasn't there? And I'm struggling to think. I think it was a case against Santander, but it might have been Abbey National, but it was definitely a banking case. And there was a case on precisely that point.
Yeah. So it's a normal human reaction, right? And that's the problem, is it's managing that normal human reaction and being aware that's you know, that's a situation. And, you know, see it all the time in employees where the employment is continuing. And, you know, it's a case of, right, say, for example, someone's raised a complaint about discrimination, they might then be in the pool for redundancy. And I'm not saying that you would victimise them, but I think as an HR team, it's something you've got to be alive to. So, yeah, you know, coming back to getting your ducks in a row, is it likely that this employee could make a complaint that they're only being selected, or they're only being put at risk even because they've made the complaint? So if you can turn around and go, no, here's all the perfectly objective justification reasons as to why we're taking this action, totally unrelated to your complaint, then obviously you're going to be in a much better place.
It's certainly something that I've had numerous examples in my career of having to manage client emotion on, because when you have got a really difficult situation, you know, that might involve performance management and, you know, issues of discrimination, because it's very easy to say I'm being performance managed because, you know, I'm being discriminated against, and part of that is performance management. And then there comes a point where every single thing that happens is raised as an act of victimization in the true legal sense by the employee. And that's then really difficult, because actually what I found in sort of multiple cases is throughout my career is there comes a point where the management of that is very, very difficult and very emotionally draining for the client, and the client then just wants to sack them. And I've had to have multiple conversations where I've had to look clients in the eye and say, look, I totally get it, right? I know that this is a massive hassle, but I really need you to understand that if you do that, you're moving from a situation where you've done everything right, and I know it's painful, but ultimately this person doesn't have a good claim, and you're going to wrap them up a claim and you're going to put a little gift bow on it and give it to them. And that's really something that we want to avoid. So, you know, it's really worth thinking about that, because in my experience, emotional reactions in employment law don't tend to lead to good outcomes for the most part.
And I think this probably comes back round to, you know, the treading on eggshells point, which we've just talked about. You know, poor manager is probably going to be absolutely terrified that everything they do could be deemed to be an act of victimization. But I think that's where, coming back to the point we talked about last week in our grievances, is that a mediation process might be the way forward, because you'll get a really good idea. And I'm completely veering off topic now. You'll get a really good idea of whether or not the relationship is going to be sustainable. by the way that the parties behave in mediation. And if it isn't, then obviously that can then lead on to sensible conversations about whether or not either one of them should be moved, or if your business isn't big enough, whether or not, you know, you follow up from the mediation and you have a chat with them and just go, look, if this isn't going to work, let's have another conversation.
Yeah. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and I think probably it's worth just touching at a very, very high level on the two other areas that are specific to disability discrimination. Adrienne, if that's all right.
Yeah, so go for it.
What I'm thinking about here are two things that you just need to make sure you're aware of, and I'm sure you all are. The first is if somebody is disabled and they meet the test for disability, so they have a physical or mental condition that has a substantial impact on their ability to carry out day-to-day activities, and that's either long-term or it's likely to be long-term, and never forget that second bit, because likely to be long-term is also relevant. Then you as an employer, if you know about that disability or you ought reasonably to have known, you have a duty to make reasonable adjustments. Now note the word they're reasonable. I could do a whole session on reasonable adjustments and completely unreasonable adjustments, and you know, the former, not the latter, is what you need to do. But just be aware of that, because it's easy to get caught out. So really important to have that communication process if you find out that someone suffers from a disability. The other point, and I don't want to leave the session on a sort of pessimistic note, but it probably is the easiest claim for an employee to succeed on, is discrimination arising from a disability. What that means is that somebody has a disability, so again, they've got to get over the hurdle of meeting the test for disability that I've just described. And something that arises as a result of that disability then causes them to be subjected to a detriment. So a really obvious example of that is someone has got cancer and they are required to take a large amount of time off of work because of that. But that's not, there's no reasonable adjustment made to their attendance triggers. And as a result, they are treated unfavorably. Yeah. Sorry, I made a mistake. I said less favorably. It's not less favorably, it's unfavorably. Mm-hmm. So they are subjected to, there's no comparison there. If they are subjected to something that they can argue is a detriment, and as you said, Adrienne, they're disciplined or they're dismissed because of that absence, that then is a problem, because that is likely to be a successful discrimination arising from a disability claim. And the causal link between the detriment and the thing that arises from the disability and the disability itself doesn't have to be sort of, it doesn't have to be a particularly high bar. So I'm always telling my clients, look, let's just watch out for that arising from claim, because people often don't think of it and it kind of creeps in at the back door. Again, there's an ability to objectively justify whatever it is that's happened. But it is just worth being aware that that particular claim is looming there in the background. It's always worth just thinking through, okay, when I'm taking an action, is it because of something that arises from that person's disability? And if so, am I sure that I can objectively justify it? And actually the concept of PCPs is also relevant there. So that's a very, very quick run through, but it's just two more watch outs that we wanted you to have before we finish. And it's 11:29.
So we have just been asked a question, which I think if we answer it potentially really quickly, with the caveat that it's quite a big question and maybe we should do a topic on discrimination later. But the question is, what advice would you give to employers who employ a disabled person but may not be able to make their employment adversity free, i.e. a charity that leases a second floor office space without a lift that employs such a person? So, reasonable adjustments, and this comes back to what we're talking about, reasonable adjustments. And Sarah, I do think it might be a good idea if we did a session or a 25-minute session on reasonable adjustments, because you don't need to move heaven and earth. So what's reasonable for one organisation may not be reasonable for another, and it's all about looking at the size and resources. So in this very specific example that you've given us, you lease a second floor office space, you're a charity, so immediately you're starting to think, like, what might be reasonable. What might be reasonable, for example, is just throwing out some thoughts. Sarah, tell me if you think I'm way off the mark, but you know, is there an additional room downstairs that you might be able to lease, for example, which would enable that disabled person to have access? Yep. If that's not the case, is there a situation perhaps, and again, this is about like showing that you're trying, you know, is your lease starting to come to an end? Is there scope to go to your landlord and say, you know, is there any chance that we can lease the ground floor at the end of our lease? I don't know. I'm just trying to throw things out there so that you can write them down and go, yes, this is a possibility. No, this isn't. We'll take it off the list. Yeah. Is this person able to work from home, for example? Now, that's a bit of a double-edged sword, because equally you could say, if you know, if we can't sort out the physical space, we're making you work from home, they may say, well, I'm being then treated less favorably because I'm not integrating with the team. Yeah. So that's a bit of a dodgy one.
You might have an arising from claim from that.
Absolutely. I think, but again, it's part and parcel of it all, isn't it? But
yeah, 100%. I think other things I would think about, one, I would think about talking to your landlord, because and I'm sorry, I haven't had time because we weren't doing a deep dive into reasonable adjustments today, but I think we will, because a couple of people have said they'd like us to. Thank you, Becca, for answering the question that I was going to do next on the chat. But I think it's worth talking to your landlord, because my understanding is that the requirement to provide kind of auxiliary aids and to have buildings that are disability friendly would actually fall back on the landlord as well. So I think that is something that's worth looking at, because that goes beyond employment law. The other thing that's really important to remember, and I think we will do a deep dive on this, so I'm not going to harp on because we're over time. But the other thing to remember is that cost is not something that a tribunal will look on favourably at all, even if you are a charity, in terms of providing that reasonable adjustment or that safe working environment.
Not cost alone, it's got to be cost and something.
Yeah. Exactly. So cost alone is a reason for justifying not doing something for a disabled person, for example, is really a no-no for the tribunals. And that's not always very realistic in a business situation, but it is a fact. So that's something to think about as well.
Wow, that went quickly.
I think we told you it was a massive topic. We've whizzed through, but we will take the feedback on board, and we'll find a slot to do a reasonable adjustment session before we finish this particular cycle of Employment Law 101s. In the meantime, thank you so much for attending today. I hope you enjoyed the session. Thanks for all your interaction. We absolutely love getting the questions and the feedback as we go along. It's brilliant. Tell your friends. We want to get as many people as possible along to these sessions. We're on Spotify. We'll be issuing this as an alerter if that comes into your inbox. And by the way, if you could add us as a favourite, the NPM legal alerter address, because otherwise things might go into your junk mail. So check your junk mail, forward it to your friends, follow us on LinkedIn. We just want to help as many as people as possible with these sessions. So please tell your friends.
Thanks. Oh, and just one last thing. Sorry, just one last thing. We've got a break for half term next week, but the week after, and I've no idea what the date is, but the week after next, we're going to be talking about 3rd of March. Thank you, Sarah. We will be talking about Tupi. So we look forward to you joining us then. That's hands again to finish. Right. Thanks ever so much. Have a good day, everybody.
Bye.